Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello and welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell the stories that traditional media tends to ignore and help connect you to the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio today by Jason Wood and Ben Graff from Quarles & Brady. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Ben, why don't you start us off with just a little bit of context about your work, the kind of work you do at Quarles & Brady, and Jason, we'll have you go after and introduce yourself, and then we'll jump into the conversation. Ben?
That's great. I like the tagline, stories that you tend to ignore. That's good. I sometimes feel that I get ignored as well, especially sometimes at home. So thank you for being here so people could actually listen.
I'm glad we could fill that gap.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. You're filling my personal needs today.
Excellent.
So I'm a bit of a odd card in real estate. There's not many of us out there zoning attorneys. We kind of blend the world of politics, real estate law, and door knocking, talking to neighbors about what we think is best for the neighborhood and how the developers can help make our cities a better place. So if basically the best way to round up what I do is if I'm stuck in my office all day, it's rare. I'm out talking to neighborhoods, council members, mayors all across Arizona, trying to really build up literal development and improvements to our cities.
That's wonderful. I want to learn more about how you got into that kind of work and what your day-to-day experience is. Jason, you're the chair of Quarles & Brady's Real Estate Practice Group. Tell us a little bit about your work.
Yeah, and while Ben's out doing the fun stuff on pound and pavement, we're behind a desk. So we help people to paper deals, structure their joint ventures to kind of bring everything together, ultimately, from finding and acquiring land to deciding what to do with it to folks that use real estate for operational purposes and everything in between. Really, your contracts.
Yeah, so you've got a broad experience in this whole area, joint ventures, commercial leasing,
everything,
acquisitions, yep, and dispositions.
Exactly.
I'm reading this out of your bio. These are not
Thank
words
you.
That come naturally
Thank
to me.
You.
I literally know nothing about commercial real estate, so I'm very excited to have this conversation. Ben, as you say, this is a unique kind of legal practice. Take us back a little bit. How did you get to this point? Did you start out, as a young man thinking someday I want to be a zoning attorney, or did it go slightly differently?
It went very differently. In fact, in mid-road, even in law school, there was a nice, fat, juicy zoning law course that I could have taken, which I didn't even know about at the time. So it was definitely not the direction I was going in. I've always balanced my life with kind of one foot in public advocacy or public service. I've always balanced school and even work with kind of that outside involvement. So it just kind of led to a perfect type of work where I could balance my civic engagement with Arizona politics. I'm an Arizona native, so kind of blend my knowledge of Arizona. And also, use that law degree, practice law, help advise on the real estate front, and frankly, enjoy what I do for a living.
Now, at what point did you settle on zoning? At some point, you must have thought you were heading either to be more of a generalist, or you had a different idea in mind. Do you remember the decision point and what was happening?
Oh, my whole passion was to be a state legislative lobbyist. That was what I originally wanted to do out of law school. That was the direction. I wanted to influence bills of the state legislature. And within 1 year of practicing in actually a couple different areas and trying to get my foot in the door at the legislature, a couple mentors actually helped steer me in a different direction. And I ended up really loving what you can get done at the municipal level, which led me then to my land use and zoning practice. So in my experience, I can get things done quickly at the city, working with council members, mayors, and staff, and make the biggest impact on residents.
Jason, what about you? How did you get into commercial real estate? And talk us through kind of your backstory.
Happy to do so. Yeah, my path is also fairly non-traditional. I started out graduating from law school and knew I wanted to be an in-house lawyer and do practice corporate law. And that's exactly what I did. I was in-house counsel for a publicly traded company for several years and was a consumer of legal services. So understood and like to think that I still understand what folks who are buying legal services ultimately want. And then the bottom dropped out of the market. That company ended up closing multiple, one headquarters here and multiple other locations. And I find myself looking for a new position in 2010 in Arizona, which was interesting. From there, was lucky enough, blessed enough to be able to find a position practicing real estate law with another firm, and moved over to Coral several years thereafter, and have been lucky to get some great clients and do very interesting and sophisticated and challenging work ever since. So,
let's begin to dive into the topic of commercial real estate, because there's a lot of things that get covered under that umbrella, and particularly in such a fast-growing market as ours. Can you begin to help differentiate some of the different dimensions of the commercial real estate market? What are some of the major pieces that might move independently or might work together?
Yeah, I mean, first asset class, right? You've got retail, you've got industrial, you've got office, you've got residential, right? And residential has multiple different subsets. You've got, multifamily, you've got condominium, you've got master plan mega communities. Within master plan communities, you've got retirement communities, age restricted and so on and so forth. So you've got developers that specialize in one, you've got developers that specialize in multiple. You've got folks that, are using real estate as an operating asset, but are acting as developers. So there's really a lot of great ways to get involved. And it's, as I mentioned, it's always interesting.
Ben, anything you want to add to that? You're in the trenches or in the weeds sometimes, looking specifically at individual pieces of land and the zoning restrictions and so on. What does it look like from the micro end of that spectrum? What's our market consist of in your view?
Absolutely. I mean, we have clients that approach us and say, we understand you guys do real estate and zoning, but do you do industrial? Do you do multifamily? And the answer is we've done it all. You can't get involved in this market with the uptick we've had in the economy without having your hands in every single type of project. So from my point of view, though, and for our clients' point of view, everything we do is about the use, and it's the story behind the use that I'm sharing with the community, with the city council. When we're bringing in multifamily, we're talking about the ability to bring more residents to an area that might eventually support that downtown grocery store that will eventually bring in an economic driver in that area. So, we are telling a story behind every use, and every single type of real estate, from industrial to retail to homes, everything plays a part in this economy. We always have good stories to tell.
Can you give us an example of a project that had all these different dimensions, the community relations, the municipal government, the law? I mean, it all intersects, at a particular location, at a site, at a corner or at a parcel or something. Can you give us an example that might help to understand some of these different factors?
Absolutely. In a prior firm, I was one of the lead attorneys on the Ritz-Carlton case in Paradise Valley. And we focused for practically almost 2 years, which is rare. Zoning cases are typically a 6 to 8 month process. This was about 2 years of negotiation with the town of Paradise Valley and the citizens. As you can imagine, this was the largest swath of vacant land in Paradise Valley, and really for many, many square miles that had remained vacant. I mean, I used to ride my bike on that parcel with friends, as a kid. So that development, as you can tell, brings in luxury hotel industry. It brought in residential. It's bringing in an incredible amount of retail. It's the perfect storm of everything that we want to revitalize that area of Paradise Valley and also Scottsdale. Very, very proud to have been a part of that work. And I think, another perfect example too, which started with a lot of legal issues, is the southwest corner of 101 and 202 in Tempe. That was pure landfill, absolute garbage, literally garbage. And my client took the time to remediate that land and prepare it. Now we have hotels, luxury multifamily, retail. We have new restaurants coming into that area and almost 3 hotels opening on that site as well. All of that took negotiating with the community, rezoning cases, working with the mayor and council, bringing it all together, and also making sure that in the future there's not too many legal encumbrances on that.
You've mentioned the community, and I just don't understand enough about how the process really works to know the involvement here, but clearly you do need buy-in from the
Absolutely.
Folks. How does that play out in a zoning case as you're working back and forth between the municipality and the residents themselves?
Sure. I mean, if you're good at what I do, you respect the heck out of the neighbors. You have to. You have to be able to put yourself in their shoes and understand why they may— like or dislike or be concerned or have a misconception and not scold them for having that misconception. We go through all kinds of processes. One of my niche areas is affordable housing. So if you can't resonate in your own brain why a neighborhood could get the wrong impression about what affordable housing is, you're missing the boat, right? So the community has an ability throughout all of our cities to participate in public hearings, talk about what they like and what they don't like. And the good teams are out there meeting one-on-one. I can't tell you how many times I've sat in some person's living room talking about a zoning case and helping feed their cats. I mean, it's just ridiculous what we do, and I love every minute of it.
I mean, it really, in a way, is the fulfillment of that young man's desire for public service and advocacy. It's at a micro level, engaging with citizens, being a liaison between clients and the municipalities, and really navigating that. Jason, in your role as well, you are constantly managing the conversations with lots of different stakeholders, as they're officially called, but they're people. What are some of the different interests that might play out? And again, at a very general level, it's going to be everybody, but maybe you could find an example of a particular project, a particular venture that brought a lot of these things to life, something that you really enjoyed or struggled with executing.
Yeah, you know, we build consensus as well in the transactional world, and certainly it's usually with opposing counsel, right? We're trying to get the other side to agree that you know, the way we want to structure this deal, the way that you know, we want to build this hotel, the way that anything wants to, you know, come together is the right way to do it. You know, in terms of particulars, right now we're working on a luxury hotel project in a very nice area. And, you know, you're always dealing with your neighbors. And as Ben said, you want to be respectful of them and make sure that everyone has buy-in. So on the transactional side, we're kind of seeing things on the ground, you know, floor and kicking it up to Ben to the extent that it needs to, you know, be involved in the municipal level. But it's always about building consensus with the other side, whether that other side is your joint venture partner, whether it's your seller or your buyer or your, you know, your landlord or your tenant.
Things have been really good in the Valley for a few years after being brutal in 2008, 2009, 2010. As you look ahead, well, no, let's talk about the present first. What's your assessment of where we're at now compared to, let's say, 5 years ago, Jason?
Well, I think things have been great for quite some time, right? I mean, we obviously had quite a slow uptick. I don't think in 2015 people were saying, this is wonderful. You know, I've gotten my job and I'm making a ton of money. Arizona has been behind the curve in terms of, you know, other states and localities that have picked up. And I think that's good for us now that this upswing, especially in the, you know, capital markets, has been it's quite long in the tooth, right? The yield curve has flipped. Last fall, Bank of America called the top of the resale market in residential. So, you know, certainly there's going to be adjustment coming. I think we're much further behind than everyone else in the country might be, you know, our neighboring states and so on and so forth that have had really large upticks. But I think it's positive. I still think that, you know, people are not, the fundamentals are great. That's, you know, that's what we're seeing. We're not seeing people test their assumptions like they used to. We're not seeing deals based on irrational exuberance and things like that. So I feel positive about the Arizona market. And frankly, you know, the types of jobs that we're bringing in are going to be supportive of the type of economy that we're building.
I mean, certainly looking at the trends, the amount of companies relocating large amounts of their workforce to Arizona is a very positive sign that people see something unique in this environment, both in terms of, you know, the economics as well as the quality of life, the availability of real estate,
right,
to grow. One of the questions that I've asked a number of different guests on this program who look at this from different perspectives is, to what extent do you feel as if there's almost a state or regional economy that is somewhat out of sync? You alluded to this in your answer a minute ago, in that our recovery was a bit slower, but there may be more stability and sustainability in that as well. Do you think that if things do start to turn over in other markets, it's going to have a quick effect on Arizona, or will we be able to ride that more sustainable long-term growth curve?
I should probably caveat this and say I'm just the dumb lawyer, right? I'm not making the—
None of us have a crystal ball.
Right, of course.
I'm just the dumb social scientist.
I'm the smart lawyer.
Okay, good. Well, we're glad that Ben is here. He'll solve this all for us in a second. So I'm the anthropologist.
Want to put a point on that,
bud? No, I'm not that smart.
Okay. Anyway, I do think so. I think the fundamentals are much better, as I said. I think that our economy has changed significantly over the last 10 years. I mean, you look at where we were in 2009, the types of jobs we had, you know, the focus of our economy has been for some time very focused on real estate back office and the like, and we're bringing in tech companies. I mean, the governor has said, you know, that Arizona's open for business during both terms, and he's been right. I mean, GPEC, Chris Camacho, that group, they've done great jobs bringing people to the Valley, and we're all the better for it. So,
yeah, Ben, you do have a unique perspective on this, given that on the one hand, you're looking at the larger trends, but you're dealing with individual cases after cases after cases. You're kind of working both sides of the spectrum. What's your take on how things are now compared to 5 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even going further back, the 2006, I bought my first house. 2007, decided to become a zoning attorney and base my entire income on the real estate market. And so I rode that ship to the very, very bottom, very, very bottom. And so as many of us do who were really in the weeds during that time, have an incredible appreciation for where we are now as opposed to then, and really, really get excited every day about what we do and the direction of the market right now. Now, Jason's completely right. I mean, so many of us are asked to pontificate on the market, what's going to happen. None of us know for sure. I will tell you that the kinds of deals that we're seeing, both from, and this is important, both from the private side and the way a city evaluates that project, everyone's a lot more careful. Everyone's a lot more thoughtful in terms of whether or not this is going to be the best use of a land for the future. And we see it in all of our deals. We see lenders are still more cautious than they were pre-2007, 2008. I think all of that combined and the fact that our uptick was a bit slower so we could learn from the rest of the country, I think we are more insulated. And I think that any type of a correction, I believe, will hit Arizona less than the rest of the country. But that's just my two cents.
You know, Jason, you mentioned some of the emotional qualities of decision-making. Humans being human, we always make bad decisions, especially about economic matters, where emotion only produces effects.
Right.
It's not, is there a sense in which people consuming too much of the national news might skew their behavior when, in fact, as you say, fundamentals are really solid and they really should be looking to more local sources of more local metrics and stories about how things are going?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's easy to, that's the term of art I use, right? Irrational exuberance, Ben Graham, the intelligent investor. I do think that's the case, but I would add that, luckily for us, and there are people on the sidelines that are waiting for a down cycle, right? They're waiting for that downtick, and they've been smart about it.
Because they want to shop at a discount, or what's
exactly? Yeah. I mean, last time I think it took a lot of folks by surprise. I really do. You hear the story of for example, John Paulson and others who have bet against the market, but there weren't a lot of them, right? Not a lot of folks made billions of dollars based on the down cycle in the real estate market. Most people lost millions of dollars. On this time, this time around, people are ready for it, and that's why, when they're evaluating projects, I can only speak for what I see, of course, but clients are looking at, well, let's test our assumptions. Let's look at, what happens if, we don't get the tenant we think we're going to get in this development, or, we don't get this type of, approval from the city or the municipality. They're testing all of those, and they're making sure that things are going to work. And when you run into problems, or when, always, at least from my vantage point, when you see clients going back to projects that they rejected early on because there just wasn't enough of an internal rate of return or other profit metric. And I've not seen clients coming back for more on those. It's not to say it's not happening. There have also been some great, what I would call matters that have spurred growth, like opportunity zones and the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which is could be a whole program in and of itself, but we're heavily involved with that. Essentially means that designated census tracts in Arizona are designated throughout the U.S. are designated as opportunity zones, such that investors can pool their funds, invest in these areas, and their tax on the gain from sale that they would have invested is deferred until 2026. And then if they hold it for a long enough period, 15% of that gain, they don't have to pay taxes on. If they hold it and then they continue to hold it, amounts following 2026 would not be taxed. So I think that has spurred and will continue to spur growth in Arizona. And I think that, you know, as long as we have pro-growth policies in place and are bringing in business, it should certainly be a much different adjustment when there is one.
I mean, it certainly seems to me, as a non-native, I moved here from California 6 years ago, that Arizona's doing some things right with, a lot of things, but particularly with regard to what we're speaking about today, you know, things in the news like the governor's commitment to recognizing the licenses and certifications from regulated professions in other states and granting them essentially, if not automatic, but very easy relicensing, recertification here seems to me to be very pro-growth. It's a really smart idea that just because somebody got a medical license or a cosmetology license or anything, you know, in Michigan, they should be able to come and start working here quickly, leading the way in that. That's at a very small level for the solopreneur, the small business owner, but all the way through to folks dealing with really large relocation projects and, you know, the eye the nation's biggest companies have on what's happening here seems to me quite interesting. You know, news again yesterday about Microsoft doubling down on its acquisitions in the West Valley. Just a lot of interesting things happening. You've both been involved in some pretty massive development projects, some small ones as well. But what are some of the highlights? What are some of the things that really speak to you to these trends? Can you give us some examples or some color, Ben, that might help us to understand what's going on?
Absolutely. I think, you know, what I've been inundated with over the last few years are multifamily developments. I mean, our thirst in Arizona for multifamily, both affordable all the way through luxury. I have literally the full spectrum of clients where you have one of my projects where you literally can have butler service and somebody, you know, put the chocolate on your pillow and it's a rental unit, to affordable housing where we've got, you know, single family firefighters, police officers, single moms. We've got the whole gamut getting excellent quality housing. All of that is the multifamily market. So numerous clients have been able to come in, ride that wave, and we still don't see an end to it. We still see multiple forecasts saying that our main municipalities need incredible amounts of multifamily and other housing. And I will comment on the one thing you said. I mean, allowing non or transferable business licenses by having that type of economic driver, you think about how the home building community reacted to that. You know, they know that there's going to be that many more people influxed into Arizona that need new homes. Think about an entire company who their entire workforce needs to be licensed in a certain way. They can now move their entire company over here. So we are going to continue to see that growth. I mean, it's a seller's market right now in the home buying community. Pretty soon we're going to need to respond to that. And that's good news that the home builders can come in and get some of those products back up.
You know, one of the things that is interesting to me about how this all plays out is that we are talking about, even when we're talking about economic trends and commercial projects, at the end of it all are the human beings. Whether a large company, you know, an Amex or something that has a lot of folks who come here to work for the company, having apartments nearby. You know, what for me as a father, as a family guy as well, I'm thinking about moms and kids and daycares and all of the spillage into the economy, the commercial economy, retail, et cetera. I mean, we really are talking about a very vibrant community growing together in some pretty exciting and interesting ways. Now, Jason, you're a new father. You've still got the hospital band on your arm here. Congratulations on the new birth in your family. How does that view of the way families live their lives show up inside some of the commercial real estate deals? I mean, obviously that's a factor because humans are involved.
Definitely. Well, first of all, thank you. And to the listeners, excuse me if I sound tired. We just had my wife, God bless her, just had baby number 3 2 days ago here. So I'm recovering, as is she. Certainly, you know, it's all about what people call disruption now, right? I mean, everything is focused on the consumer. you know, Amazon has clearly changed the face of retail, and retail developers have responded. And what does that mean? It means, you know, to what, you know, applying what Ben said about, you know, multifamily to retail. It's experiential. So you look at what they're doing in Fashion Square, the high-end area. I mean, people want to, they want to be served. They want to have, you know, wonderful things to eat and folks to, you know, take care of them and to help them. And then they want to buy stuff. On the healthcare side, it's about, again, better service, better quality of service, closer to homes. There are micro hospitals that are popping up around the state in order to serve underserved areas because you can't get to, you know, Tempe very quickly if you're, you know, you have to be choppered in, right? On the, you know, condominium side, multifamily side, it's the same thing. You're seeing different tastes, excuse me, you're seeing development, you know, cater to different tastes, which are, you know, dog parks, right? You're not seeing, you know, the types of things that you used to see back in the day.
My family and I live up in Anthem, which is its own kind of strange little microcosm, wonderful community, a lot of interesting dynamics, most of which are good, and some others. And it's fascinating to me to watch, you know, our little community in unincorporated area of Maricopa County kind of dealing with itself at the level of community and the dog park and the you know, the shopping mall and the, all the other things. You mentioned something very important, Jason, which is the shifting trends in retail are having an effect on the real estate space. I mean, we have seen over the past few years, companies, brands that nobody ever thought would be vulnerable going out of business because of direct-to-consumer, because the internet is now the middleman and leases are becoming unsustainable for some, the model that set them up that way isn't supporting the foot traffic, the ticket sales are not there. So, on the retail side, is that something that you deal with?
Absolutely, yeah.
What's playing out as people are responding to what seems to me the inevitable, but some people still have their heads in the sand about it, the inevitable shift of people's buying behaviors, which has a massive impact on the sustainability of leases and so on.
Right. I mean, stating the obvious, if you're selling a commodity, right, something that comes in a box that you buy on a shelf and that is no different than anything else, it's probably going to be sold on the internet at some point, depending on shipping weight and so on and so forth. Everything else that is, as I mentioned, experiential or, you know, trying on clothes, it's, things will change. They certainly will. But the good thing is we have a lot of great innovators in this town. I mean, you look at Tuft & Needle, you look at Carvana, you look at all these wonderful companies that have sprung up and that have developed something to, you know, make life easier for folks. There's going to be a lot more of that.
Right. I mean, shopping, there was never a time you thought mattresses would be something you bought online.
Precisely. Yeah, because how do you ship a mattress? It's too large. They figured it out. And that's what's going to continue to happen. And I see retail always... It will never disappear, right? You're never going to order everything completely online. It's just going to change. And Ben spoke about the, you know, the Paradise Valley development. I mean, that's, it's going to be an experience, you know, a high-end certainly experience that people are going to, you know, always want to gather. I mean, you look at Starbucks, the numbers of those that have popped up on every corner, people want to be together, right? They want to work alone, but be amongst a group of people. I mean, that's never going to change. So I think what developers have and will continue to respond to is they're building community centers on the residential side, you know, both owned and rent, for rent rather, that are responding, right? They're gathering places, their pools, their cafes, their gyms, their everything in between. You know, the tennis courts and things like that of old are really, you know, golf courses. They're changing. I mean, those are certainly still being developed, but not at the rate that they used to be.
Right. The history of public pools in America is a fascinating history to understand how space and community and public sites and play all come together. Ben, what are your thoughts on this question?
Well, let me tell you about two interesting trends that we've seen just go gangbusters since the economy started to recover, and I haven't seen it slow down very much. So you've got your big box retail, okay? So let's say, and some groceries have gone away, as you all know as well. So, you know, let's say you get a 25,000, 30,000 square foot retail box disappears overnight. The question also is, sure, one question is certainly where are people getting their retail products, but the important question for neighborhoods and our cities is what's happening to that big box. So two interesting trends, I've been at the forefront of both. One is secondhand goods stores like Goodwill of Northern and Central Arizona, okay? They've been coming in, getting the zoning or approvals they need to take over an older store and single-handedly revitalizing that entire area. Now, you can imagine, too, that that's another area where when you bring in a secondhand store, the neighbors might not be that excited firsthand when they hear about it. But once you explain to them just not only what the stores can do, but how all the other stores survive because of it, you now have a new trend. So we've seen that a lot. The other thing that's interesting is we see a big uptick right now in self-storage. So we've got companies that are coming in, they're taking that 30,000 square foot box, they're internally making it two stories, and they're creating self-storage facilities right there, what used to be a Sears or what used to be some, you know, a Macy's or whatever it is. So there's some really interesting kind of reuse of those spaces that's keeping many of these retail centers alive.
And further to his point, I mean, that's exactly right. Arizona, you look at traditionally, how many mixed use developments can you remember that were in Phoenix before the year 2000? Not as many, right? I mean, they're changing. And for that reason, you're putting education, you're putting self-storage, you're putting, toy garages. You're putting all sorts of different cool things into these, what used to be just retail developments, and people are responding. I mean, you have office in there, you've got, you know, multifamily and things, you know, to kind of, you know, live, work, play, as they like to say, is what they're trying to cater to.
Which points at another really fascinating trend, at least it seems to me from the outside to be fascinating, which is the growth of co-working spaces. The idea that commercial real estate ventures that are serving either micro businesses or remote workers for large companies who happen to live here, and instead of working from home, an executive or an SVP from a company based in Chicago or New York might have a cubicle or a hot desk at one of the many co-working spaces that have grown up. People need to live and work and eat and play and, you know, do stuff with their kids and take care of their health. And there's a kind of relocalization happening. You know, we went through an era of mass stuff and, you know, import export, and that's not stopping. But at the same time, people need to be somewhere. You know, we still play out our lives in these physical forms, right? Until VR takes over and wrecks everything, and we don't leave our pod when our contacts or our implants.
Right? I didn't like that movie, but yeah.
Well, coming soon to a dystopia near you, right? But thoughts about co-working spaces. There's another paradigm that certainly from the number of them might seem like it's a hot thing. Some folks I have heard griping about it, but I don't understand why that would even be an issue. I mean, if you had the option of driving 30 minutes to your micro office or 5 minutes, I think, or walking or biking to, you know, I think everybody would agree, why not have, you know, one every, you know, 5 miles? I don't see the issue here, but yeah. What about co-working as a trend?
Oh, I'm a huge fan. So little known secret, I joined Quarles & Brady in September, brought my whole zoning practice over there to start working with Jason and their team. Before that, I owned my own law firm, and I was faced with turned out to be a wonderful decision between coming to Quarles & Brady or continuing my own law firm. And my law firm was going to be placed at that time in a co-working space. And it's a fascinating environment. I got to dive in. Just the neighbors you have, the small companies around you, the vitality of the ideas, and the youth. And I don't mean that literally in age. I just mean it in vigor and in excitement of all these people being around. So I'm a huge fan of that. And I'll give you another great example. In Scottsdale, just a couple of years ago, I did a case where we took an outdated office. It was an office site that literally the original construction company was in the 60s and 70s. And Mayor Jim Lane, who's now the mayor of Scottsdale, his development company actually built that building back in the day. They were dilapidated, not being used. We did a zoning tweak. Sure, they put better, you know, remodeled on it, beautiful job. But we did a zoning tweak that allowed what? It allowed a joint coffee shop and restaurant to be a part of what was once just office. That site just sold for one of the highest prices per square foot for an office space because of the location, because of the great job the company did, but also because of that co-working. Everything was there for them from an environment, from an interaction, and from restaurant. And so those are the kind of tweaks we can do at Quarles & Brady with just the zoning aspect alone.
Exactly. And I think I read a book about 15 years ago before I had children, when I was able to read books. Other than law books.
With small print.
Right,
yes,
right. Exactly.
Now that's about the shorter time. Sentences.
Yeah, this is about the last time I saw the sun, I think, before I had children. Yeah,
exactly. In any event, it's called The World is Flat. I don't remember the name of the author, but ultimately, the premise.
It's the New York Times guy. I can't remember.
Exactly. Yeah. You got it, which is the
Thomas Friedman.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. I mean, so you know, right? But essentially that, you know, communication is going to take over, right? I mean, there's no need for us to all be in the same room every single moment discussing ideas. We can be elsewhere. You know, this is a global economy. And that's exactly what co-working supports, right? I mean, why would I commute an hour to and an hour from when I can live, you know, 5 minutes from a co-working facility and get my job done with the same quality and perhaps better quality of life for me as I would being, you know, driving with that type of commute. I think that, you know, as far as a trend, I don't see it as that. I mean, Regis has filled the need for many years. I think that, you know, there have been a lot of great folks locally who have done a wonderful job building out facilities that and Ben has just mentioned, that, you know, keep folks even happier. And I think that it's going to continue to change. I really do. I think that we'll see more of them. I don't think that it's going to be, you know, and that's why I say it's not a trend. I think this is probably the new normal. I think that, you know, and we getting into what does office space look like today versus 15 years ago? I mean, cubicles are gone. You've got open office space. You've got smaller offices for, you know, everybody the same size. So, you know, these types of things, certainly they ebb and flow and they'll always change. But I do think that co-working will continue to evolve and grow because there's a big need for it.
And the way we work is evolving and growing. And that's something that I think is equally fascinating. A book I'm looking forward to read, but I haven't picked up yet, is Brave New Work. And I can't remember the author's name, Adam somebody. And basically the premise of the book is that, well, we have innovated in nearly every area of our life over the last 100 years, from the stuff we make to the stuff we consume to the way we live, to our health, to everything else. The one thing that has not changed is the bureaucracy of large organizations. It's an outdated model. It's broken. There's a lot of not just toxic bad behavior, but inefficiency and anti-innovation that happens in large organizations. And what we need to do is, and some companies are doing, and they're described in the book, Brave New Work. They're really rethinking, well, what do we need here? Why do we have to do it this way? Why are those folks siloed over there and these folks over here? What if we took the org chart and flattened it or rethought it? And, you know, there's an example that I heard the author discuss of the world's largest tomato producer, where everybody sets their own salaries and their own work schedules. And there are armies of, you know, Harvard MBAs that say, you can't do that, that will never work. And they are the most effective and efficient tomato producing company in the world. Extremely profitable. People who work there are very happy. And they just started with this question. Well, why can't we try it? What's safe to try? What could we do differently? So I think in your different ways, you're at the forefront of facilitating these questions that people are asking. Well, what could we do in this space if we thought about it differently? Maybe having a coffee shop and a community garden and a daycare out the back is actually a really good idea,
right,
for this car dealership or what have you. I don't know, right? But certainly the question of how we use our space and how we organize ourselves is a very fascinating question. Jason, you mentioned micro hospitals. I have no idea what that is. What is a micro hospital and what's happening there?
Yeah, full service hospital, but just in a much smaller footprint, right? So you look at the hospital campuses that are around our valley and they're mega, right? They're huge. Many of them lease space to physicians. You've got all sorts of specialties and so on and so forth. These are typically, you know, 15 to, you know, a couple dozen beds, sometimes larger. And they serve all sorts of high acuity, right? So if you're similar to an emergency room, you can show up there. Similar to an urgent care that we saw popping up all around the valley for many years, and that served a great need. But these are located in areas that are underserved by hospitals. Frankly, folks that would have to be airlifted, as I mentioned, somewhere else. And my understanding is that around the country, we've seen these to be very effective and successful around the country, and they're just starting to pop up in Arizona.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me when we question our basic assumptions, what we're capable of creating together.
There you go.
Right? Ben, let's talk for a minute about something else that connects people, the light rail. I know you've had lots of clients impacted by light rail. I know this is a hot topic. Again, it's something I'm not personally all that familiar with. What's the status of that issue? What's happening? What's the good, the bad, the ugly about light rail?
And I am very biased on this subject. I don't hide it. I'm very pro light rail and pro light rail extension in the city of Phoenix. not only as putting on my city planner hat, but also because of the clients that I've serviced that are depending on it. So for the listeners that may not know, the city of Phoenix has had two separate elections that have verified that the citizens want light rail and want it to move forward. However, that being said, a recent referendum did meet the requisite number of signatures to place the light rail in jeopardy in two ways. One is many believe that the delay that's already occurred may jeopardize the federal funding that's essential for the light rail in Arizona, and we're monitoring that. Second, we are going to have a second vote or third vote on the light rail where citizens once again are going to be able to vote on it, and we're hoping through communicating that we will once again get support for that. Let me give you a tangible example. So one of my affordable housing clients only in the last year and a half went through the full rezoning process, the eight-month process, Phoenix City Council, meeting with city planning staff, adhering to all of the development standards, and actually building a site or designing a site plan and construction plan that was dependent on the light rail being next to it. And also, the building itself is wrapped around and going to be compatible with the light rail. Well, so they're already through that. They have building permits. They're starting to break ground, and the very section of light rail in front of them is now in question on the ballot. What does that developer do? And what does it mean to that developer legally and practically when that light rail line is taken away from a use? And by the way, this is affordable housing for the elderly, very intentionally placed along a public transit line. These are some of the stories that are lost. Now, don't get me wrong, there's can be side effects of the light rail that the city has to take responsibility for. I have a separate client whose business is going to be essentially put out of business just because of the orientation of where the light rail extension is going to be. So we're working with the city to try to figure out what's best for that company. But I think those growing pains are worth what's going to be the overall economic impact for the light rail in Arizona.
Certainly raises the question of, you know, what is a public good? What kind of community do we want to live in? Do we want to live in a city where people of all different kinds of needs are supported, or do we only want to look out for our own self-interest? I mean, you can obviously hear how I'm skewing my values in this tend towards yours, which is, listen, communities need to move. They need to eat. They need to drink. We'll talk about water before we wrap up here. Jason, you wanted to jump in on that as well?
Yeah, I was just going to say that the transportation is essential to the success of any in infrastructure, right, of any large metropolitan area. I mean, we are a very spread out community. The Phoenix MSA is, you know, very large, right, compared to many other much, you know, places that hold more people.
Inland area.
Right, inland area. Yeah. Thank you. And so, you know, we have to be thoughtful about that. And there are, as Ben mentioned, there are going to be short-term, hopefully, consequences on business owners. But I think that, you know, those are the prices of progress. And ultimately, as you said, the public good is that the light rail serves a need. Arizona has you know, always pushed back on something like this because we're of our summer climate, right? I mean, it's hard to jump from you know, light rail to, you know, and walk through that type of heat. However, you know, things are changing. And as the sprawl continues and urban sprawl, frankly, you know, builds up, I feel like that's going to continue to help us all, you know, get to where we need to be.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I wouldn't overthink it. I've lived in some pretty hot places. This is certainly up there. And, you know, people adapt. And
exactly.
The reality is that to not be able to leave your house at all to get groceries or to go to social events or has a huge impact on the quality of life. So, you know, many dimensions as well. Ben, just a follow-up question. You asked rhetorically, what does a developer do in that situation? And I'm curious, what's the answer to that? What,
sure.
What does a developer do to either increase the storytelling, the advocacy, or what? What happens?
Well, see, what we want to avoid, and I can tell you what developers want to avoid, is, you know, for example, I joke that I'm an attorney, but it's true. I'm an attorney that's never sued anyone and never will, right? And people that are outside of the legal field look at me cross-eyed and say, how is that even possible? Well, that's just not what I do. I consensus build. So have I advised clients that that's their only opportunity? Yes, but if I can I keep them out of it? Absolutely. So what we don't want is the development community being put in these situations, and the only way they can be put back in place is some type of litigation. We don't want that. It's not good for development. It's not good for the city. It's not good for progress. It's not good for that site. So a site like that, those are the developers that need to get out and tell their stories, maybe through their attorneys, but also through other people, because what this has turned into is a campaign. There's nothing different between a campaign and a referendum. And the campaign topic is, do you want to elect Mr. Lightrail or do you want to put Mr. Lightrail out of office? And that's how the development community wins this argument, is being very proactive and getting involved in that campaign.
Yeah, really owning the story, owning the media, but also really the conversations that need to happen. As you say, in someone's living room, feeding their cat, really talking right. through the dynamics of what does this actually mean? I mean, there's so much more openness and transparency in our society. And at the same time, there's so much more fear. And certainly the media, other types of media have played a role in profiting from that fear and resentment and anger and worry. And when we don't choose to play that game, as you choose not to litigate, we choose not to fan the flames of fear and disconnection. We have to approach the conversation differently. We have to listen as well as talk. We need to understand where somebody's coming from. They may have a legitimate fear based on an inaccurate piece of information or an assumption. And so it's not that their fear is the problem. It's that they didn't understand or they were told something. They were ill-informed. So I'm inspired by what you're doing. Now, one last thing here before we wrap up. You, Ben, also are in the middle of a six-year term on the Central Arizona Water Conservation District Board.
You nailed it.
Yeah, well, it's written down right here in front of me. And
I'm still impressed.
Yes, thank you. I will take it. And I didn't realize that the Central Arizona Water Conservation District Board oversees 40% of Arizona's water supply from the Colorado River. So we have multiple sources of water. And this is also a contentious issue, as much, if not more, than some of the things we've talked about. What's happening with the board, with the drought contingency plan? What's new? What's interesting? What's challenging with regard to water in our state?
Absolutely. And it's completely interrelated to everything Jason and I have been talking about. I ran for this office in 2016. If you want to become a popular politician that everyone loves and admires, this is not the office to run for. No one even knows it exists. There's 15 of us on a board that oversees all of our Colorado River water allocation, which was at one point deemed a renewable source of water. And we've realized, now going toward the 19th year of a very significant drought, that based on tree rings, we have not seen the like of in over 1,200 years. 1,200 years, that was with two zeros. So we are facing the fact that our water is getting less and less from the Colorado River, and we are also third in priority in terms of our Colorado River water. California, where you came from, you know, you lost your priorities by coming over to Arizona. You went from first priority Colorado River to, you know, over here. So I don't know. I hope that was a good decision.
Time will tell.
Time will tell.
1,200 years from now, the archaeologists will know.
That's right. That's right.
It was. I'll say it was.
It was.
Thank you.
Yeah. No. And actually, I was being facetious to make a point, which is because Arizona has been at the bottom of our priorities, we have been the best water managers in the absolute country. As you've seen the California water crises that have occurred, you haven't seen that mirror in Arizona, and we're in the middle of one of the most arid deserts. So the drought contingency plan, also referred to as DCP, this was a plan that was enacted by the CAP board in conjunction with the Arizona Department of Water Resources and the governor's office, and then forwarded to the state legislature, and then forwarded to Congress, and was signed into law by Congress last week in an unprecedented, very quick turnaround of an act by Congress. So our Congress can get things done within a relatively short period if they put their minds to it. So keep that in mind, believe it or not.
They think their constituents will die of thirst.
Right, exactly. When it comes to those really you know,
it's hard
issues.
To reelect them if they're, ossified.
That's right. Uh-huh. That's right. Yeah. If you don't have enough water to get to the polls, it's hard to reelect your congressman. But that plan, in a nutshell, is going to preserve our ability from getting into a severe cut of Colorado River water in the future. We will see cuts. We are going through a historic drought. We are going to see cuts, but the drought contingency plan approved by my board, it's going to keep us above the level that of basic safety. It's not a permanent solution. We'll have to look at something else as about 2026. Way in the future, we're going to look at desal and some other solutions. But for now, I think Arizona is in very good hands. And I'll just conclude that by saying We don't get these companies. We don't get the intels. We don't get the manufacturers. We don't get these companies coming to Arizona unless we have a secured water supply. In fact, I would argue there's not one thing that's more central to economic development in Arizona and development itself other than water.
Yeah, that is a very good point. And if you look at some of the fastest growing economies around the world, 11 of which are in Africa, this is these fundamental taken for granted resources are of primary concern to companies, to investors, to people looking to build, because they're not short-sighted. They're asking themselves, you know, what's 200 years from now look like? And are we building and investing in an area that's going to sustain what we're up to? It's an interesting combination of both inspiring and disconcerting to realize sure. how dependent we are on a fairly, fragile environmental situation. But parting words, Jason, as you look out at the world from your seat as chair of Quarles & Brady's Real Estate Practice Group, what is inspiring you? What are you excited about? What do you see on the horizon that's helping you get out of bed despite the sleepless nights with the new babies?
Well, outside of my family, there are certainly, as I mentioned, there are just wonderful things happening in Arizona. Ben mentioned that he's been here for a long time. My family's been in the state since the late 1870s. So I'm excited to see what we've done. I mean, I grew up in Tucson where, my grandfather wore a bolo tie and was a rancher. And here, the sky's the limit. We've got great people running our state. We've got great people running the companies that are helping our state to grow. And we're going to continue to see investment as long as we continue to have the attitude that we have today, which is that, bring us your thoughts and we will be thoughtful about, or bring us your thoughts on investment rather, and we'll be thoughtful about whether we can accommodate those or if not, we'll figure out something.
Arizona's a real character.
It does.
In the 50 states.
It does.
And some of it is stereotypes, but as I spend more time here and talk to more people and my natural curiosity, leads me into conversations I wouldn't have expected, I'm really intrigued and excited by something that seems to be different here than other places. And even as more folks like me move in from California and other areas, there's something about the Arizona character that seems the positive dimensions of it for sure that seem to be attractive to people.
It's a meritocracy, right? That's how I like to phrase it. I mean, you are what you make of yourself. Anybody can come here and be successful and build a company and sell the company, keep the company, whatever. We've had those success stories for many times over, and I think we'll continue to have them for years to come.
Jason Wood, chair of Quarles & Brady's Real Estate Practice Group, thanks for sharing that perspective and thanks for being here today. Ben, what does it look like for you from the zoning perspective or any of your other public service roles? What are you excited about? What's inspiring? What's on the horizon?
I think I'll dovetail off of something that Jason just mentioned that's unique to Arizona. We have a state that's, as the governor said, open for business, and it is a state that welcomes quote-unquote outsiders and makes them insiders very quickly. So I have counterparts, zoning attorneys that I speak with in other large cities. You've got your Chicago's, your New York's, your Boston's. When they get a client that's not inherently been in Arizona very long, that can be a problem. That's somebody from outside of the state trying to make a play inside of a new state, and we're not sure if, you're welcome here. That doesn't happen in Arizona. I have these meetings with mayors and council members, and I'll introduce a client that just brought their business to Arizona, and that's a 3-second discussion before we get on to what is this company going to do in Arizona now, and how are they going to be a part of our economy? The other thing that's just inspiring is the creativity. We're seeing developers reinvent themselves. We're seeing companies reinvent themselves. We're seeing completely new products come into the market, which are making zoning and planning departments scratch their heads because it doesn't fit any one category. And I love it. Those are the fun cases, just the weird, crazy stuff that's going to work in our new economy and make Arizona just an amazing place to live.
That's marvelous. I'm inspired by what you're up to, and I'm looking forward to the future. Ben Graff, zoning attorney at Quarles & Brady, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And for all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre. We'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.